The Accords call for justice, freedom, and democracy, and guarantees for the inviolability of all forms of life and liberty and the safety of the people. They call for an authentic, pluralistic, and participatory democratic process to promote social justice and respect for human rights. These provisions were also unacceptable to the U.S. government, since it is obvious that they cannot be met or even approached in the U.S. client states without the dismantling of the government structure dominated by the armed forces and the security services. Having eliminated the provisions applying to the United States, the media then faced a second task, to remove the practices of the client states from the agenda. This problem was readily overcome by the same means, simple refusal to report the facts, or marginalization and distortion when they were too visible to ignore entirely. State terror in the U.S. client states escalated, but no matter. The laser-like focus of the media was on Nicaragua, which received far more coverage than the other countries combined, virtually all of it concentrating on departures from the Accords as interpreted in Washington. Another unacceptable feature of the Accords was the role given to international monitors. The U.S. brooks no interference in its domains, and the international presence would inhibit violation of the Accords, thus interfering with U.S. intentions. The first phase of the Accords ended in January with a report by the International Verification Commission. The Commission had the bad taste to condemn the United States and its clients while praising steps taken by Nicaragua. Obviously, it had to go. The New York Times cooperated by suppressing the Verification Commission report, and under U.S. pressure, the Commission was abolished. The victory was complete. Not a shred of the original agreements remained. Nicaragua responded by announcing that it would satisfy the terms of the former accords unilaterally, requesting international supervision to monitor its agreement alone. The loyal media responded by announcing that finally Nicaragua had agreed to comply with the peace accords, although, of course, communists cannot be trusted. Meanwhile, state terror continued to escalate in the client states without, however, influencing the judgment that Nicaragua alone was responsible for violating the accords. And that is the correct response, given that the United States and its clients were now exempt by Washington media edict. In the New York Times, the terror was barely noted, apart from guerrilla terror in El Salvador, to which the government sometimes responded, Times correspondent James LeMoyne commented with regret. With the accords now restricted to the question of Nicaraguan compliance with Washington's dictates, the crucial issue became the willingness of the Sandinistas to negotiate with the CIA-established civilian front for Washington's proxy forces. The text of the accords required no such negotiations, but the accords had long since been dismissed to oblivion. In early 1988, Nicaragua did agree to this U.S. condition, reaching an unexpected ceasefire agreement. Meanwhile, the indigenous guerrillas in El Salvador and Guatemala were consistently rebuffed in their efforts to negotiate. But these facts were suppressed as irrelevant, in conformity with the Washington media version of the accords. Where not suppressed, the facts were simply denied, as when Jean Kirkpatrick wrote in the Washington Post in June that Duarte has seen his generous offers of amnesty and negotiations rejected by the FMLN guerrillas one by one. This pronouncement followed Duarte's rejection of a series of efforts by the FMLN, the political opposition, and the church to arrange negotiations. The Nicaraguan ceasefire was signed on March 23rd. The agreement stated that only humanitarian aid will be negotiated. It further stipulated that this aid must be in accordance with Article 5 of the August 1987 Accords. The aid is to be channeled through neutral organizations. Secretary General Suarez of the Organization of American States was entrusted with ensuring compliance with the agreement. Congress responded by voting overwhelmingly to violate the terms of the ceasefire, approving $48 million in aid to the Contras to be administered by the State Department through its Agency for International Development. The aid would be delivered in Honduras and within Nicaragua by a private company, James LeMoyne of the New York Times reported, quoting Contra leaders. The phrase private company is a euphemism for the CIA, for which the Agency for International Development has admittedly served as a front in the past. By no stretch of the imagination can this agency be considered a neutral organization. The congressional legislation stipulated that all aid must be administered in a manner consistent with the March 23rd ceasefire agreement and in accord with the decisions of the Verification Commission established by that agreement, for which Secretary General Suarez was the responsible authority. Secretary General Suarez wrote a letter to Secretary of State George Shultz on April 25th, in which he drew his attention to this passage of the congressional legislation. The Secretary General went on to state that reliance on the U.S. Agency for International Development was in clear violation of the ceasefire agreement. He expressed his deep concern about this whole situation. He emphasized further that Article 5 of the peace accords, which determines how aid shall be delivered under the ceasefire agreement, quite explicitly rules out any assistance whatsoever to the Contras except for repatriation or resettlement. Aid can be sent to the Contras within Nicaragua by means agreed by both sides as a means towards their reintegration into normal life, but for no other end. Washington disregarded the objections of Secretary General Suarez, the official in charge of monitoring the agreement, and all of this was unreported in the media, to my knowledge, and the illegal operations continued. Alan Woods, the head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, said that the aid would have to be delivered by private American aircraft in violation of the ceasefire agreement. The New York Times article reporting this is headed, "Official Sees Problems on Contra Aid. The Big Hurdle is Sandinista Mistrust." The U.S. Agency for International Development then began delivering supplies to the Contras in Honduras, violating the congressional legislation that stipulated that the aid was to be delivered in ceasefire zones, all of which are in Nicaragua, and violating the ceasefire accord, since the Agency for International Development, a U.S. agency, clearly is not a neutral organization. All of these facts were largely ignored by the New York Times, which offered a different version. Robert Peer alleged that President Ortega has blocked deliveries of the aid authorized by Congress on grounds that the deliveries would violate the ceasefire agreement. Unmentioned in his report was the fact that this was also the conclusion of the official in charge of monitoring the agreement, Secretary General Suarez. His name actually did appear in the article, but only in the context of the Reagan administration decision that he had not met their financial accountability standards. So therefore, Washington had not disbursed the $10 million provided by Congress for the commission to verify compliance with the ceasefire agreement. In further violation of both the agreement and the congressional legislation, the Reagan administration sent funds to the Contras to spend as they wished. The national media remained unperturbed, in accordance with the doctrine that the United States stands above any law or international agreement. Meanwhile, the United States Treasury Department announced a new ruling barring import of Nicaraguan coffee processed in a third country. According to the ruling, such Nicaraguan coffee will not be considered sufficiently transformed to lose its Nicaraguan identity. It suffices to replace the word Nicaraguan by Jewish to know to which phase of history this edict belongs. During the same months, negotiations on a political settlement broke down through the device of demand escalation by the Contras, no doubt following the State Department script. Each new government agreement, going far beyond the terms of the long-forgotten peace accords, simply led to new demands. The government of Nicaragua continued to urge resumption of the talks, receiving no response from Washington or the Contras, who continued to add new demands. Even Cardinal Obando, who barely conceals his sympathy for the Contras, urged them to return to the talks to no avail. There followed what the Council on Hemispheric Affairs describes as a CIA-managed campaign of provocation and internal disruption inside Nicaragua. This established a false crisis atmosphere in which Congress could turn to new aid for the Contras. Congressional doves implemented legislation providing continued aid to the Contras. The long-term goals have been obvious from the outset. It is necessary to demolish what Archbishop Romero called the people's organizations fighting to defend their most fundamental human rights. It is necessary to eliminate any threat of independent nationalism in the fledgling democracies. If Nicaragua cannot be restored by violence to the Central American mode, then at least the United States must implement the reported boast of a State Department insider in 1981 to turn Nicaragua into the Albania of Central America, that is, poor, isolated, and radical. The United States must ensure that Nicaragua will become a sort of Latin American Albania, so that the Sandinista dream of creating a new, more exemplary political model for Latin America would be in ruins, in the words of British journalist John Carlin. These goals have largely been achieved. The U.S. media, serving as adjuncts of government, deserve a large share of the credit.
The 1988 Massey Lectures continue tomorrow night on ideas presented by Noam Chomsky. Several weeks ago, Professor Chomsky gave a talk on the subject of the media and democratic thought control to an audience at Ryerson Polytechnical Institute in Toronto, after which he was questioned by a panel of Canadian journalists who'd also read an advance copy of the lectures we're presenting this week on ideas. We're broadcasting parts of the panel discussion each night this week as Professor Chomsky responds to questions from the panel. This is Gene Allen, foreign editor of the Globe and Mail.
Many of the things you describe about how the elite press in the United States sees the world are replayed to us through some of the main communications links that we rely on, such as Associated Press, Reuters News Agency, New York Times News Service. And I think many Canadian journalists are in the position of recognizing a strong U.S. bias in those reports, and are active in, that's one of the day-to-day challenges, is trying to find ways of getting around that. One of the things you can do is get your own correspondents there who have a different point of view, or try and get local stringers. You can't do that all the time. But I just wonder from that, from my point of view anyway, it seems that perhaps a lot of what you describe could be simply interpreted as kind of the American press playing cheerleader for the home team. It's just like there's a kind of sports writer who's called a homer, you know, and the home team can do no wrong. Can you look at it that way, just as an issue of American foreign policy? And yeah, countries like Canada can have some effective room to maneuver in terms of covering the world.
Well, I think there's something to that, but, you know, we have to be careful about what's the home team. I mean, for example, what the American press defends is the interests of elite elements in the United States. Now, it may be that the general population is strongly opposed to elite elements, but they're not the home team. It's the elite elements that are the home team for the reasons that I mentioned. So on, say, Central America, there's no doubt that the general population has been pretty much opposed to these policies, but the home team is in favor of them and the press is in favor of them. And let's take Vietnam, the Vietnam War. There, that was very interesting. At first, the general population was strongly in support of the war, But it changed. By about 1969, the population was largely opposed to the war and on interesting grounds. The population was opposed in principle. Again, you take a look at the Gallup polls. Up until today, or at least 2 years ago, which is the last one I saw, about 70% of the population regularly says the Vietnam War was fundamentally wrong and immoral, not a mistake. Now, among opinion leaders, it's not 70%, it's like 40%. Opinion leaders includes clergy and businessmen and so on. When you get to the real intellectual elite, the percentage is about zero. Even at the peak of opposition to the war, like around 1970, the real intellectual elite, you know, as picked by various standards, was of course opposed to the war. So was everybody, including Wall Street, but because it was just not paying anymore. But they were opposed on pragmatic grounds. It wasn't working. It was too costly. It was maybe too bloody, and so on. But fundamentally wrong and immoral, not a mistake. That's That position is barely expressed in the ideological system, but it's the position of about 70% of the population. Now, here we have a striking case where, you know, the home team that you're working for is not the general population. It's a very specific interest in the general population. I think that's true in a lot of issues. Let's take, say, turn to a totally different question. Take a nuclear test ban. Just through popular grassroots organization, the population was about 75% in favor of a nuclear test ban 2 or 3 years ago. Elites were strongly opposed to it, liberal, conservative, everyone else. They were so strongly opposed to it that when the Soviet Union declared a unilateral test ban, the media barely covered it. I mean, they noticed it and disparaged it and told various lies about it. And when it was renewed, it was barely even covered. It was hardly even an issue in the elections, even though 75% of the population was in favor of it, had virtually no elite support except maybe an occasional gesture. That's a very strong elite position, but it's not reflecting the general public. So I think there's something to what you say, but I think one has to be more discriminating about how to define the home team. The home team means the people who own the country and therefore ought to govern it.
Or the official home team.
Yeah.
Peter Worthington, editor of the Ottawa Sun.
Your talk of the Vietnam War, the turning against it, and you said for moral grounds because it was an immoral war.
On the general population, yes. Not the elites.
My view would be that the public turned against it, regardless of the point that I think it was a mistake, but I think the public turned against it primarily because it was a losing war. And can you give me any indication of a winning war that's been unpopular?
Well, can I give any indication of a winning war that's unpopular? See, quite honestly, I think the Vietnam War was a winning war from the United States for the United States.
It didn't look like a winning war.
But that's indoctrination.
We're propaganda.
That's indoctrination.
Oh, yeah, I see.
See, in order to decide, let's be careful.
Let's
be careful. To decide whether a war is a winning war or not, you have to figure out first why it was fought, right? That's what tells you whether it was a winning war or not.
There's a variety of ways to tell it's
winning. That's right. There are a lot of ways but one of the ways, if you're logical, is to ask what were the goals of the war and were those goals achieved. That's the way you decide whether a war is a winning war, right? If we do that, we're not going to do this in 1 second, but let me again just talk methodologically because there's no time to go through the whole story. You can look up the documents. There's elaborate documentation on the background planning for the Vietnam War, elaborate documentation on the high-level planning. And the main concern all along was that independent nationalism in Vietnam might be what was called a rotten apple that would infect the barrel. It might have a demonstration effect throughout the region, very much like Nicaragua. And there's a way you deal with that. The way you deal with a virus that might infect the region, the virus in this case being independent nationalism, the way you deal with it is by destroying the virus and inoculating the region from the spread. Now, that was done. The Vietnam War had a dual character. You had to destroy the possibility of independent development in Vietnam, and you had to create around it brutal military dictatorships which would prevent the spread, and both of those things were done reasonably effectively. Part of the Vietnam War was the support for the Indonesian massacres in 1965, a very significant part. Part of the concern over Vietnam was that it would encourage the growth of independent politics in Indonesia, where you had a huge mass-based, peasant-based communist party. And success in Vietnam might have spurred that on. In 1965, that party was wiped out with the slaughter of maybe 700,000 people to enthusiastic support in the West, I should say. That was part of the inoculation of the region. Same happened in Thailand. Same happened in the Philippines with the Marcos coup, all around the region. Meanwhile, Vietnam was sufficiently destroyed so the chances of it being a model for anyone else are very slight. I mean, Vietnam will probably not barely survives. You know, it's suffered the kind of fate that there's nothing to compare with in European history back to the Black Plague. You know, be a century before they even recover, if then.
So that's a partial
victory.
Why?
It's in terms. So here you didn't have a total victory. They didn't get their ultimate goal. You know, if your only
if you call success only achievement of every goal, even the minor ones, then it wasn't a victory. But if we give an accurate assessment, it was a partial victory. Partial defeat, partial victory. They didn't reabsorb Indochina back into the American system, but they prevented it from being the threat of a good example. In this respect, the American war in Nicaragua is also a partial victory. Now, we can answer the question what the American population thought about the war. We can answer it because it's a very heavily polled population, and we don't have to speculate. We can look at public opinion studies, and they changed over time. By the late 60s, the population was largely opposed to the war on moral grounds, not on grounds that it was going to fail. By the 70s, with the continued improvement in the cultural climate among the general population, those figures went up. By 1982, it was 72% answering yes to the war is fundamentally wrong and immoral, not a mistake. And those figures are particularly dramatic because there was virtually no articulate expression of this view. You go to the extreme doves, you know, Anthony Lewis and so on, they were not saying this. They never said it. What they were saying is it's a mistake. Maybe some of them might have said it's too bloody. If you want some actual evidence on this, don't take my word for it. Go to the evidence. There is an interesting study called The American Intellectual Elite. It came out around 1974. It's done by a sociologist named Charles Kadushin. It's a study of the attitudes of people called the American intellectual elite. I agree, it's a totally idiotic concept, but the people he studied are probably no worse a sample than others. I was actually one of them, so I sort of watched the study go on. This study was taken in May 1970. That's rather important. If you look back, you'll discover that that was the peak period of opposition to the war, right after the invasion of Cambodia. That was the period when the colleges were closed down, you know, the whole country was blowing up. Right at that point, this survey was taken of the American intellectual elite, you know, people who write for the New York Review of Books and all this kind of fancy stuff. There were 200 people in the sample. Everybody was against the war, but so was Richard Nixon, you know, so that didn't mean anything. The question is, why were they against the war? Well, they broke down into three categories. Most of them were against the war on what the editor called pragmatic grounds, meaning can't get away with it. A smaller percentage, I forget the numbers, I think maybe a third or so, were against the war on what they called moral grounds. Funny word. Moral grounds meant it's too bloody. In other words, you're killing too many children. You know, you kill fewer children, it's okay. Then there was a tiny group, actually it was maybe two or three people in the sample, I was one of them, who were opposed to the war on what the editor called ideological grounds. Now, the term is interesting. Ideological is a bad word, you know. What it means is that this statistically irrelevant sample, you know, like 1% or something, were opposed to the war on principle, namely on grounds that aggression is wrong, even if it succeeds. See, if they had asked the question, what do you think about the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia? The question wasn't asked. But if it had been asked, everybody would have been against it. Nobody would have been against it on pragmatic grounds because it worked. And nobody would have been against it on what are called moral grounds because it wasn't bloody. You know, they only killed one person or something. So it's on moral grounds.
You asked everybody that question
everybody would have been against it on ideological grounds, except nobody would have called that ideological. You would have just called it human or principled
but
or something.
Not in the Soviet Union.
I'm talking about the United States.
Yeah, but don't put America on Russia's war.
Sorry.
Have the Soviet Union talk about Vietnam.
You're missing my point. My point is that opposition, that in a U.S. study, opposition to an American war, to aggression on grounds of principle, is called ideological, and it is marginal when it's U.S. aggression, and it's considered normal and proper when we're talking about Soviet aggression. Now, here's my point. At a time when the population was moving towards large-scale opposition to the war on grounds of principle, the intellectual elite was only by statistical error did you find anybody who was opposed on grounds of principle. And that's at the peak period of opposition to the war. I think those things are pretty revealing. In fact, I think there's, in my view at least, there's a kind of a split that's taken place in American culture, an interesting sort of split between educated elite opinion, which in fact is jingoistic and indoctrinated and reactionary and so on, whether it calls itself liberal or something else, and the general public, which is moving in another direction.